The following episode of The Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
Here we go again.
Give them hell, Clarence.
Yeah, it's kind of early. Let me have my whistle. You gotta give them the whistle treatment.
Clarence Elliott is here, and he's going to tell you a little bit about eternal life. I'm not a preacher, and I'm not drunk. I formed a new party called the Eternal Man's Party. Clarence Elliott is going to make you a super human being. If I can just convince one follower, one person amongst all of you is what I'm trying to say, then I believe that I have accomplished something. So you listen to me when I tell you. The Eternal Man's Party. So I want you to follow me. Please! 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 Take my hand!
Welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me this week is special guest Marisa Young, who runs the Timothy Carey Experience blog.
Hi, Mike. It's truly an honor to be here. I want to thank you for asking me to join you here today.
We're going to be looking at the 1962 film World's Greatest Sinner, a tour de force from writer, director, actor Timothy Carey. Folks may remember that I talked about Carey in the past when we discussed Bob Rafelson's Head, where he played Lord High and Low. Timothy Carey was a wonderfully quirky actor, completely unhinged. There was something wild and unpredictable about him that came through in even the most controlled films. He's the single best argument against the idea that Stanley Kubrick was some kind of control freak, because there was no controlling Timothy Carey. He was in two and almost three Kubrick films. So, Marisa, what is it about Timothy Carey that captures your fancy?
I have to say that the first thing that I noticed about him when I noticed him was his sheer physical presence. I mean, he was 6'5", 6'4", tall, big guy. And in Paths of Glory, especially, the way he contrasted his physical presence with being vulnerable and terrified of going to his death. The dichotomy there struck me. Just the way that he gave his all to whatever part he was in, even if he was only on screen for 2 minutes, you remembered him and your eyes went to him. And when he was gone, you thought, well, who was that guy? And is he going to be on again? And also, I have to say, I'm a great admirer of his fierce independence. I mean, he refused to fit into the Hollywood establishment, the system. He had his own ideas about doing things, which sometimes brought him up against certain directors and producers and actors who got frustrated with him because he didn't do the same thing twice in rehearsals. He would do it one take one way and another take another way because he had all these ideas bubbling in his head and preferred to listen to those ideas instead of what he was told. He certainly pushed boundaries and tested limits. And absolutely, with World's Greatest Sinner, he did that in spades.
Where to begin with summing up World's Greatest Sinner? I guess I should say it's the story of Clarence Hilliard, an insurance salesman who tires of life and decides to become a god. He does so by any means necessary, be it by performing some raucous rock and roll, seducing old women, forsaking his family, or challenging the Judeo-Christian god to a fight. That sounds simple enough, right? But there's just so much more to it. I mean, talk about independence. This was such an independent effort on his part. I can't even believe sometimes that he got this film made.
I know. I think he probably couldn't either. 4 years, $100,000 of his own money, basically, most of it. And he wanted to do it his way, and the studios looked at it and said, no.
I can't even imagine him taking it through the regular studio process.
They were aghast.
the premise seems to change as the movie goes along. Like, there are so many times where everybody can be a god, but then he kind of buys into his own hype and he says that he's a god. Mm-hmm. And then at one point he's like, well, when I become president, it's like, what?
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're running for president.
What? What? What happened?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think his original idea was to, you know, he had seen so-called controversial films, right, that Hollywood was doing, like Unwed Mother that he was in, where he plays right. an abortionist. I'm sure that he looked at movies like that and thought, huh, you want controversy? I'll give you some controversy. And he certainly did that. Mm-hmm. The original title that he had come up with was Frenzy. And he was seeing how things were going in the world, like with the rock and roll was starting and Elvis, and how easy it was to whip people up into a frenzy and maybe make them not use their reasoning faculties as much as they might, and how they could get sort of sucked into things that you wouldn't normally get sucked into. But then as filming went on, it seemed to take on this other aspect started coming about, the religion and the spirituality aspect started really coming to the fore. This character who is either Satan or an emissary of Satan comes to him and says, you've really got some influence going on here. You should run for president.
It feels like they were very much making this movie as they went along and making it up as they went along. Because it's weird because that character does seem like he's an emissary of Satan. But then at times I look at him, I'm like, isn't he his boss from the insurance company?
He does kind of look like the same guy, doesn't he? Yeah.
He looks a lot like him. But then you've also got the snake going on, too, who's kind of narrating the story a little bit, but then drops out, but then comes back. Okay. And then you said that that's Paul Frees, who is Boris Badenoff's voice, right?
The one and only.
That's crazy.
Isn't that great?
Was he the same Paul Frees who was the director? Because I know that a guy named Paul Frees directed stuff, like The Beatniks, one of my MST3K episodes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the same Paul Frees. Yep.
Yeah, he had such a great voice. It was so nice whenever he would speak.
There's Clarence, my boy. Just like any other male. The only difference is he wants to be God. And that's coming right out of the horse's mouth. There's Edna, his loving wife and her brood, following Clarence to the very end. She had no choice. Alonzo, the gardener, Clarence's faithful friend, astute in the art of picking weeds.
It wasn't Hollywood in terms of the way that it was made. Obviously, it was made outside of the studio system and made with a lot of non-actors. Some kind of real rough performances going on in the film, other than Carrie, his gardener, for one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was Gil Barreto, really good friend of Tim's. I believe they were roommates when Tim first arrived in Hollywood in the early 50s. So he knew Tim for, you know, the rest of Tim's life, and they were good friends. And he had some things to say about it. He said that Tim got so into the character and filming, and it was a stressful time in Tim's life, and he started being nasty to the bit players. And so Tim would give their lines to Gil, because Gil's part was originally small. And so Tim would give their lines to Gil, and it ended up that Gil had a rather more substantial role in the film than they had originally planned, because all the pit players were quitting because Tim was being so mean to them. And Gil himself even said that it was very difficult to be around Tim at times during the making of that film, because he invested so much of his physical and emotional energy into it that he started getting a little crazy, even more than usual.
Right. Well, it's a real rough movie as far as like the editing goes. It reminds me a little of Manos, The Hands of Fate, speaking of MST3K. It feels like you're kind of jumping into the middle of every scene. Like, the beginnings and endings of scenes just don't seem to be there, but we're like getting the guts, you know?
Yeah, I noticed that a couple times too. I thought, wait, that scene just ended. What happened? What's going on?
Right. Like his epiphany at the insurance agency, they kind of cut to it, and there's that woman who is speaking. You don't hear any words coming out of her mouth. And then later on, you do hear words come out of her mouth, but obviously they're not her words. She's completely overdubbed.
Yes, I believe it's ridiculous to have insurance.
Why don't you save your money?
That's right, ma'am. Thank you. Don't be alarmed. They didn't really want insurance anyway. As head of this department here, I'm going to do something that's never been done before in insurance history. I'm giving every one of you the day off.
Are you serious, Mr. Hill?
I certainly am.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding. It's such a wonderful time to enjoy yourself this time of the year.
What about Nolikoff?
I'll take care of him. You go on, Harry. Every one of you, take the day off with my compliments.
You sure, Clarence?
That's it, Harry. Say hello to your wife and kiss for me. That includes you, dear.
Anchorage Insurance, Mr. Hilliard's office. I'll call for you, Mr. Hilliard. Are you in?
What's the question, dear?
What's the question, ma'am? A policy concerning funeral expenses.
Quicker. All right. Yes, I wouldn't even bother taking out insurance policies on funeral, dear. Because when you die, your body starts to stink.
That's right.
They'll give you a free burial. I wouldn't worry about nothing. No, no, you don't need insurance policies that cover your burial funeral. That's right, dear. Thank you.
It's a head-scratcher, but it's so damn entertaining at the same time. It's almost like an experimental film. You know,
it is.
It's a narrative.
Yeah, I don't know if exactly, you know, what his thought processes were while he was editing. And I can't help thinking that if he had had I don't know if he was so independent that he wouldn't accept any help from anybody. Tim, we can help you edit this movie. No, I can do it myself. So I don't know if that's what happened. And I can't help thinking that if it had been more competently edited, that it would be the most famous underground movie ever.
I wish that somewhere in a vault that we will soon find is the raw footage of it, and maybe we can see what those tails and heads look like. Maybe they were crap, and maybe that's why he cut them, but it's just strange. It's strange. The movie reminds me of A Face in the Crowd a little bit.
Yes, very much
just
so.
Just like a crazed version of A Face in the Crowd, you know?
Yes.
I mean, I know that Andy Griffith, you know, kind of goes off the deep end as the movie goes along, but man, oh man.
No, that's a good comparison. I thought that too. It also reminds me of one of those lurid Jack chick tracks come to life. You know?
Oh, yeah.
Tracks.
I can totally see that with like one of those like devils that has the actual horns and stuff.
Yeah.
The haw, haw, haw kind of thing. And then we should talk about the music too. I mean, speaking of Facing the Crowd, you know, there was Dusty Rhodes kind of got into America's heart with his music.
Yeah.
I don't think the music in World's Greatest Sinner was going to get into many people's hearts, but it was definitely going to whip up a crowd.
Oh, absolutely. Even though you can't really say that Tim had any, could, you know, play the guitar or anything. The band behind him, Art Fine described the band as sour and atonal and as something out of the Cramps' worst nightmare, but it works.
It totally works.
It's like, but it's fabulous.
I would totally go see Clarence Hilliard and his atonal backup group.
So would I. And when he drops to his knees and says, please take my hand, you're like, You can see how he would have some influence over people.
Was all the music written by Frank Zappa, or was just the score and the opening song written by Zappa?
The score and the opening song, I know for sure, were written by Zappa. The rest of it, that's a good question.
Because I've always wondered who wrote those lyrics for Please Take My Hand.
Yeah,
you know?
It was probably
very intricate.
It was probably Tim.
You really only been playing 2 weeks?
Yes.
What do you do ordinarily besides this?
I'm a composer.
Ah. Might we be familiar with any of your songs as yet?
You'll be familiar with some of my songs as of next week, but I did the score for The World's Greatest Sinner.
And who might that be? Tommy Manville or who? Tell us about that.
That's the name of the film. It's The World's Worst Movie, and I did the music for it.
The World's Greatest Sinner?
Yes. It's a Tim Carey production, Frenzy Productions.
Frenzy Productions.
It's an independent company.
They all are these days, the way things are going. But
they shot it in El Monte.
So listen, they shot my agent in El Monte. You know, so that could happen to anybody. Who's in it?
Tim Carey and a cast of 1,000 people that he found down on Main Street someplace.
The World's Greatest Sinner. Does Tim play the title role?
Yes.
And you wrote the score for that. What instrumentation did you use? 3 harmonicas and a bicycle, or what?
Well, we had a 55-piece orchestra, and we had a very unusual reed section. We had...
They couldn't read.
We had contrabass clarinet, 4 bassoons, 2 oboes, English horn, 4 flutes and piccolo, 4 trumpets, 4 horns and 4 trombones and a tuba. And I forget, there's a bunch of...
A partridge in a pear tree. Well, it sounds like A very interesting inventory.
We recorded it in the Chaffee College Little Theater in Alta Loma, California. Of course,
it was a runaway production then, wasn't it? Right down the line.
For 12 hours we recorded.
I think he was just kind of embarrassed by it all. I don't know. I don't know if he was expecting it to be a big Hollywood premiere type movie. I'm not sure. I think he just ended up seeing it and just kind of went, oh, huh, really?
Well, for me, I wonder if Zappa was joking around. I mean, because he could never really take a lot of what he said seriously.
That's true, too.
So I don't know. But I know that it seemed like Carrie was pretty hurt by the comment.
He was, yes.
Yeah, so. Something that he carried with him for the rest of his days. But because the music is great.
Oh, it's fabulous.
And the opening song, once you get it stuck in your head, you're not going to forget it. Have you ever heard the cover of it by the A-Bones?
Yes, I have. Yes, with Tim's introduction. That's very possibly the last professional gig that he ever did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was in 1993, and he passed away a year later, so... It's very possible the last professional thing he ever did.
All right, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more from Inside the Projection Booth.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today.
Ahoy, mateys. This is KAB, Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340 KAB.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at AdamandEve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out AdamandEve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at AdamandEve.com.
Long live the true Bond! Okay, bones, more bones, the world's greatest sinner. You get all your bones together, the right bone connected with the left bone, and the left bone and the crepitus ventris, the gastroc femur bone, and the latissimus dorsi bones, the world's greatest sinner. I'm nothing but A bones.
Cold.
back. That was the aforementioned cover of the World's Greatest Sinner theme by the A-Bones. So, Marissa, how does the World's Greatest Sinner fit into the overall Timothy Carey oeuvre for you?
I would say that it's probably the best available look that we have into his psyche, his worldview, his, you know, the way his mind works. It deals with some pretty heavy themes, you know, the God and religion question, the herd mentality, mass hypnotism type of thing, only working to earn a living, which Tim certainly was not in favor of. You know, he wanted people to love their work and do what they loved to earn their living. And that's what he did. Even though sometimes it's challenging when you're watching it, technical wise, it's certainly way up there. Everyone who is a fan of Tim's should definitely treat themselves to seeing this because it's totally unique in every way.
Unfortunately, there aren't too many times where you can see him on screen for that long. I mean, there, you know, you had mentioned Paths of Glory, which is great. One of his longer performances. Mm-hmm. And Kubrick had used him before in The Killing. I think that might have been the first time that I had ever seen him. And he was just so amazing.
Yeah.
And just that role was just so complicated. It could have been really simple, but the way that it was handled and the way that he is, and just, you know, like he's put into this horrible situation where he has to basically be racist to get this guy away from him so that mm-hmm. they can carry on with the heist and everything.
Exactly.
Just, oh, so good. So good. And then after that, I would start to see him popping up here and there. And again, like you, just every time he was on screen, it's just like, who is this guy? This guy is amazing. You know, I think I tracked down the Finger Man.
Oh, yeah,
to see
yeah.
that. And oh,
he's fabulous in that. That's the movie that Stanley Kubrick saw and said, oh, I want him for my next movie.
I can totally see that. Just the way that he sits there and he just,
yeah,
it feels like he's about to go off so much during that movie.
Mm-hmm. The way he paws women like they're like he's trying to figure out what they are. What is this thing here? You know, not right. even in a lascivious, lustful way, but he's just kind of like, what is this?
Him in Crime Wave, the original Crime Wave, when he's just sitting there with that mm-hmm. that leer on his face yeah. and the leaving the wife alone with him. It's like, oh no, yeah. don't leave her with anybody else.
Whose idea was that? He really made an impression with that one.
What are some of your other favorite Carey roles? I know that's a loaded question with you. But...
Well, Bayou.
Oh yeah.
Poor White Trash. That's really the one that really got people's attention also. When he does his dance, you know, the crazy dance.
Oh yeah.
And just his whole presence in that movie is like, someone described it as a confused teenage gorilla. And he's kind of like that. And that part could have very well just been a garden variety bad guy in the hands of another actor. But Tim kind of had this, he seems like sullen and confused and like he can't control himself.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's dealing with something that he doesn't understand and he can't control. And that makes him slightly more sympathetic than just, you know, some guy lumbering in going, That's another great one. There's a Daniel Boone episode that he was in, The Blackbirder, where he's mm-hmm. in it almost the whole thing, and he's priceless. He's funny, and he's practically on screen in every scene, and he's just great. Minnie and Moskowitz, the five-minute scene that he's in at the beginning of that. I keep saying it's one of the greatest depictions of raw humanity that's ever been put on screen. I mean, this guy is just so real. And he says, you know, everyday people, you know, we should get rid of them. But doesn't he realize that he is everyday people? I mean, Killing of a Chinese Bookie, I love him in that.
Yeah, that was one of the great things is that he kind of got in with Cassavetes and mm-hmm. Falk and that whole Ben Gazzara, like that little mm-hmm. group of guys, and seeing him pop up in those movies. And they seem to know, kind of like Kubrick, they seem to know how to use him.
Exactly. Kubrick and Cassavetes divined something in Tim and they weren't afraid of it and they wanted to draw it out. And they wanted Tim to express himself. But at the same time, I really think that Tim appreciated a firm guiding hand because he was just so full of ideas and energy and himself that if someone said, oh, just do whatever you want, he like, what do I do? Yeah. So in the hands of really class A directors like Kubrick and Cassavetes, they were smart enough to recognize that they had a gold mine here. Tim could be trusted to do what he felt the character needed within the confines of the script or, you know, what the director had in mind. I think Cassavetes once said that I don't tell my actors how to act. They're actors. They know how to act. They know how to bring to a character what needs to be brought. That was the way with Tim. And Tim was very lucky to find people who understood him that much to let him have pretty much free rein with the character to let him express the character the way he saw fit.
Now, I'm a big fan of Columbo, you know, speaking of Peter Falk.
Yes.
And, you know, Falk would bring in a lot of those guys. You know, Gazzara directed a lot of episodes, and Cassavetes was in one of my favorite episodes where he played the conductor. But Carey, I loved him. He was in three. Mm-hmm. He was like, other than like the sergeant guy that would kind of go back and forth with Columbo on some of the episodes, weren't very many recurring characters, but he was one of the recurring characters for two episodes.
I was like, yeah, come on, bring him back again.
I know. Yeah. And then, because it was a shame, because, yeah, he was Bert with It's Chili. I was trying to get Columbo to eat some chili. It was the cure for all of the ales of war. And it seemed like there were a couple times where he was ready to start doing other things, but Falk was not just going to have any of it.
Yeah,
you know,
I got them to do. Like, oops.
But that was fun. That was fun. It was so much fun to watch. I think Dead Weight, was the one.
Yes, that's the one where he's in it more and they're, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And where he's talking about his war helmet and, yeah, yeah.
I went to either that stuff had to go or she was going. It was a tough decision.
Right. Bert, give me some chili.
There you go. Coming right up, Lieutenant. Got the best in town, you know. Let me get this chili to you. There you go, your crackers. There you go. Hope you're soon. How do you like that coffee?
What's this?
Is that black?
What it is?
That's my helmet from the war.
What war?
What war? World War II. My wife says I can never throw anything out, so the other day she put her foot down. She says either junk goes or she goes.
You decided to keep her.
It was a tough decision. Anyway, I brought all my war trophies over here. Hey, wait a minute. You're one guy that can appreciate this. I'll get you another bowl of chili. My chili is good no matter what it is. Here. Yeah, I got this, that. Look at this. Like I say, the Japanese stirring spoon. I got on the Okinawa, the commissary. Yeah. Oh, well. You know, I guess my wife is right. I can't give anything away. Especially when it means something to you. Yeah. That's a long time ago, Lieutenant.
Right, give me a dime.
Okay, Lieutenant. There you go. Let me give you that bowl of chili I dropped on you. Is that cream and sugar in that coffee?
Then I love that he comes back again as Tony, another barkeeper, in Fade Into Murder, which is an amazing episode. I mean, all the guest stars in that. To see him and Shatner and Koenig all on screen at the same time, it's like, oh, this is so good. I kind of wish that there had been more Shatner-Carey interaction. That would have been wonderful.
Me too. Well, did you see the Gunsmoke episode, Quaker Girl?
I did not.
They are both in that.
Oh, wow.
Together. Not for, you know, the whole episode, but yes, they are both in that together.
I have to ask you, how do you go about finding all these old episodes of TV? You were doing a wonderful job. I mean, for folks listening at home, Marisa every day posts a different picture on the Timothy Carey Experience blog. Obviously, you've got a wealth of information. You've been in so many different Hollywood films and stuff, but you dig so deep and come up with some of the most obscure, out-of-the-archives kind of stuff, and it's like, how do you even find this?
Oh, the internet is wonderful. A lot of the his stuff is not officially released on DVD, so you have to go and look for people who have put them on DVD, like from VHS or recorded it off of television or that sort of thing. iOffer.com has a lot of those. eBay has, well, not those so much, but the memorabilia, you know, lobby cards and things like that. Yeah, iOffer.com and Sell.com sometimes has the unofficially released DVD things. And then there's some other sites that do that too.
There's some great stuff. He had been in so many of these television episodes, and now luckily with DVD, a lot of these TV series are coming out and, you know, a little bit more readily available, or even like through like Hulu being able to see some of these. But you're getting stuff that has never seen or even people have thought about putting stuff out on DVD.
His appearances on the Alcoa Theater anthology back in the late 50s and Profiles in Courage in the mid 60s. Those were so hard to find. I couldn't find them anywhere. And I finally dug them up on iOffer. Quality isn't that great, but hey, there he is. When are you going to see those again? it's very doubtful that they're going to come out. There's still a few that I haven't found. I don't know if they'll ever see the light of day at all. Cowboy in Africa, he was in an episode in that. I can't find it anywhere. There's another episode of The Name of the Game. He was in two of them, and I got Fear of High Places, but Aquarius Descending is proving to be next door to impossible to find. So there's still a few out there that I don't have.
What's your holy grail? What's the one thing that you're dying to see or find more than anything?
From what I understand, he did a commercial in the 80s for Sambo's Restaurant.
Oh, man.
Where he appears as Frankenstein's monster going into the restaurant for late night, right? You know, we're open late, so, you know, come and visit us. And Frankenstein goes in to get something late at night, and we can't find it anywhere. Tim's son-in-law told me about it, and he's never seen it. He also did a Hubba Bubba bubblegum commercial in the 80s, which you can find on YouTube. But the Sambo's one, that's my holy grail.
So have you seen the making of documentary about World's Greatest Sinner? I know it's still in the works and everything, yeah. So, but I don't know if you've seen the rough cut.
I saw just a little bit that I believe that Romeo Carey put up on Vimeo, but apparently that's coming out. Supposed to be. I looked on the IMDb page for that.
Because you can always trust IMDb.
Yeah, of course. Supposed to come out next year. Other than that, I do not know for sure.
That's the real shame of the film, is just that, going back to World's Greatest Sinner, is that it was so unavailable for so long. I mean, thank goodness for the TCM screening that was, what was that, like 2 years ago now?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I mean, because that really exposed a lot of folks and really helped to get that out there. But even then, it's a 2 a.m. screening on one cable channel, and it's like, I want to be able to see this movie whenever I want to, and I want to be able to say to anybody, go see this film, and have them be able to find it within a moment's notice.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, they can. It's available on absolutefilms.net, which is the site that Romeo runs, which it hasn't been updated in quite a while, and it does still say VHS, but you'll get a DVD. That's where I got mine. So
that's good for folks to know.
Go there and get it. And everything that you buy from that site will go towards getting Tweets Ladies of Pasadena out on video, hopefully, and some other projects that he's got going. So,
all right. Well, speaking of Romeo, here's an interview I did with filmmaker Romeo Carey, one of Tim's sons.
I gotta introduce you to guys like Larry King. They're gonna teach you how to interview. Just act like you're on a bus sitting across from somebody. There isn't any question that you can't. What you have to find is your child in you that allows you to be just inquisitive and unabashed about what it is you want to find out. Are we ready to get started? I think we're ready. Okay, we're good. I was gonna bring something up because I just got an email from a film professor at Northwestern. He's putting together a film series, a film programming for students there. And he said that he's putting together a list of all these big time directors, independent directors. He had a bunch of them, Cassavetes and all the big independent filmmakers that you know about. And he said that you see these tributes everywhere. They should be side by side. Your dad should be side by side with them. That he should have equal time because he was just as meaningful as they were. Thought it was pretty neat. This guy's a, you know, relatively young guy who's done his homework on film, and he's arrived at that. It's pretty cool. Yeah, it's all right. I'm going to say accept. So anytime you're ready, Michael, let's do it. Wait, before we get started, didn't you have a partner?
I did, but actually he dropped out as of last week.
Timothy Carey was a little too big for him. That's good timing. Good timing. What was his name? Mondo? Justin could have got some mileage out of this interview. So before we get started, I want to tell you, I just happened tonight to have John Easdale over. John Easdale is a huge, especially out here in California, because when I grew up, the number one radio station was K-Rock. And this guy had more rotation on K-Rock than anybody I know. He had a one-hit wonder. What was the name of the song?
Anything.
Was that? What, did you have a girl in that? Was there a girl that you sang that to? It's like almost like someone like your wife or something.
It was about my ex-wife.
Oh, there you go.
And it was a teenage wedding. And the old folks wished us well. But
I gave you everything you want. $100 bills. Marry me, marry me, marry me.
Yes, that's you could go out. And
I went. I danced a lot to that song. That was a real big song.
It's still it's one of the most requested on that radio station to this day. It's like the punk rock Louie.
And it happens to be that John Easdale is a huge Timothy Carey fan. He's working on putting together a musical creation in a most likely, I think you could put a, what did I say earlier? A spoken word.
There's a lot of amazing stuff. So, you know, my initial thoughts were to use some of the dialogue from Sinner as bridges between songs on an album I was working with, and but now you and I have been talking about beyond that. So
yeah, I'm turning them onto all these tracks from the archive, and in the archive it's pretty amazing because my dad used a reel to reel to record a lot of his teachings when he was doing acting with students. He'd record the scenes and then he'd go over and have them listen to it. He did a lot of family recordings. My mom was she loved to sing, so we did a lot of recordings of her singing, just the wildest things. And so I could only imagine we're going to spend some more time tonight. We're going to listen to the stuff I'm transferring just recently, and a lot of stuff that I transferred working on my documentary, Making Sinner. You had a question. You said, how old was I when Sinner was?
How cognizant of the movie were you when you were a kid?
None whatsoever.
How was your first experience? What, you know, what was it like?
I didn't get to see Sinner until I was 18 years old.
What was it like seeing it for the first time?
I wasn't ready for it. I hadn't arrived. A lot to take in. It took a little. I was latent in almost everything. So Sinner was it was a study for me. But I've come to understand it in ways that you know, it's something. You know, it's a good film when you can watch it and still discover things years later. And I've seen it, I guarantee you, more than anybody on the planet. I'm going to tell you too that you could have called on a phone line, because we're actually doing this radio interview from the studio. You know, we're doing it, the same phone line from that was installed in 1958 still rings in the studio. So, and this radio little interview is being taped inside the room where most of the general filming took place. It's pretty cool, but that tells you a lot of things. It's not just, I'm not just saying it to say it. I'm saying it because that's longevity. That's a testament to something that's solid and doesn't go away easily. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And so under this roof houses all that he worked, all that he toiled on. So yeah. What's your next question, Mike White? Now that you're all alone, this is going to be quite a duel for you.
What have you discovered about the making of the film? And I know you're working on the documentary. I was wondering how that's going.
The documentary is going slowly because, you know, unfortunately, I'm not a full-time filmmaker. Number one, I'm a father. I've got two kids, two young kids. You know, I travel. I run a TV station. I put out, like, you know, on average 6 to 10 hours of programming a week. You know, so you know, the world's greatest sinner and all that is Tim Carey, unfortunately takes a back seat to a lot of things. What I do though is in my spare time when I can escape, I put together, especially if I get invited to something or there was an event, just like the event that was in Philadelphia that you came to, that gave me an opportunity to like burn the midnight oil and attempt to put something together. You got to realize I've got like hundreds of hours of things to try to just pull together. And when you start to pulled together out of the putrid mass, it's like a volcano, you know, and you want to grab pieces of lava. It's not that easy to grab what you think is right, you know, and it's just so much to choose from. And when you start piling stuff together and you attempt to edit something in a week, it's tough. But that's what I'm working at. It seems to me that the kind of attention that this needs will probably happen when I retire. Unless I find help. Right now it's me. You made an interesting comment. You said that. Do you remember what you said?
All right. I said that you might be too close to the material.
Yeah. You said, I'm afraid Romeo Carey is too close to the material, a little too close to the project. Now, what did you mean by that?
You have to have a little bit of distance from the subject, which a lot of it is, you know, just your dad, not just your dad's movie. You know, you want to paint this loving portrait, and maybe you're not ready to do the whole warts and all kind of thing. Yeah. I think that you might be so immersed, you know, you're talking about the the huge stores of all this kind of stuff that it's got to be tough for you to figure out exactly what you want to pull from that mass that you were talking about. I don't know if somebody could come in and be more objective and say, I just want X, Y, and Z, because you probably want to show the world everything and all these different facets of your dad's talent, whereas somebody else might just say, no, I just want the tip of the iceberg.
Right. Well, I got to say, I appreciate your comment. I actually find that gratifying because I know you are an avid fan, and I think you are more than anything someone who is hungry for anything that you could possibly get in a way that just opens up your mind into a closer look into my father. And because of that, I appreciate it. There's no such thing as, you know, a critique is supposed to be criticized. You're not supposed to glorify things. And I like that about you. But what you have to realize is I'm the only one on the project. So if it weren't for me, you wouldn't be watching anything.
Right.
I'd be the guy who collected enough. And actually, I'm the keeper of the archive. As much as you'd like and maybe wish that somebody further away from it might be able to handle it, there's nobody willing to go to the volcano except me. You might want to reassess kind of where we're at here. Without me, there is no making of Sinner. And I happen to at least, you know, in my journey, I've collected a lot of interesting interviews of people that no longer live that were part of it. And you said that maybe it would be great to get these guys that are still alive, like Falk and these other celeb types, but they had nothing to do with Sinner. It would have been good to talk to Cassavetes maybe, but he had nothing to do with Sinner either. My dad did that on his own. And the type of guys that you want to interview are the guys that were involved in it. Maybe other guys, you know, some like Scorsese or Coppola who watched it and would have something interesting to say. They would be a good source of an interview. But the truth is, you don't need a celebrity to tell a story about something. You can have the average Joe who happened to be part of it, or anybody who is actually just a real person telling their side of the story. And that's just as interesting to me than hearing it from a celebrity.
By calling it Making Sinner and making it about the making of that film and all that went into it, it kind of takes away some of the daddy dearest stuff or whatever you were referring to, Mike. I think that's a great, that's another story that needs to be told. Just, you know, Tim Carey's complete career and his, you know, almost his, you know, Tim Carey versus Hollywood, you know, or
right,
whatever you want to call it. What appeals to me about this film, and one of the multitude of things that appeals to me about this film is the fact that it exists at all. The fact that he took years of his life, not days or weeks or months, but years of his life to tell this story. He started shooting it when Elvis went in the army. You know, it was the early days of rock and roll. It wasn't when rock and roll has been around for 50 years like it has been now. And the impact that it has on Clarence Hilliard's life, how it changes him, that one person. But, you know, in a way, as we can see now, rock and roll changed this entire country's direction. And we went from the days, the white bread days of Eisenhower to where we are now. And it foresees all of those things. So in such a way, it's almost like, you know, he was looking at a telescope to the future. And I don't know, it blows my mind, the film itself. So if that's your purview, if that's all you're going to look at, is just that one project and how the Herculean effort that it took just to get that made, you know, you could do a 3-hour movie on just that, right? I don't know. I'm glad Romeo cares enough about his father's work to even do, you know, that we can see it. Yeah, I think he's right.
Well, it's interesting because I've just picked up, printed in Iceland too. Pretty amazing. It's the tribute. And, you know, you know about the exhibition because you were there. That exhibition was funded by the Pew Heritage Foundation and the Andy Warhol Foundation and a whole litany of other guys. That was a grant written based on identifying a 60s icon, an underground icon, Timothy Carey. And it was followed by a lot of other fringe artists that they added to the exhibition to turn it into an exhibition. But the recognition that my father's receiving now, not that he wasn't recognized when he was alive. My dad couldn't go anywhere without being recognized. How could you not recognize my dad? He's just like, can you imagine running into him? The truth is, he's more popular today than he was even then. And if we're, you talk about all these guys who were celebrities that were alive, you know, and they during my dad's lifetime, they faded away. Not that they can't be resurrected, but there's people that dedicate their lives to follow my father in ways that it's quite a tribute to someone who's been gone for that long. But here's the book, and they put a book together, and I wrote one little section of it, which I think is the end here. I put Gary Indiana wrote a section. My friend in Greece wrote a section. That's another thing. We got people in Europe. People in Europe actually recognize my father a little bit more. The credence and the attention that my father gets in Europe is greater than it is here. All the greatest independent film festivals ignore my father. What does that tell you? You don't think Timothy Carey and the World's Greatest Sinner deserves like a Sundance experience? No, can't happen. You wonder why that is. There's reasons for that, and I think they run deep. One, just the lack of overall appreciation for true independence. Just a lack, maybe not if it's probably more a lack of artistic intelligence. They don't, you know, the gatekeepers, unfortunately, aren't the best arbitrators of what belongs inside for the public to see. And that's, you know, my dad had a saying, which is as true as it was when he was alive as it is now. There isn't a lack of talent. There's only a lack of talent to recognize talent. And that's the problem with a lot of what happens in this country. I like what I wrote here at the end. I'm going to give you this real quick. The greatness of Timothy Carey, and indeed his essence, is the man as a symbol. It's not so much what he's done for others, but what others have done and will do because of his example. This is the true measure of a man. What has come out of the artistic work, his life and examples, is the kind of inspiration that can animate a generation. And the type of people that I've met, because I've been around long enough, and the celebrities that have used him as fuel and as example is alive and well. And I see it every day in terms of when you put energy into an artistic piece and you put the type of energy that my father put into his artistic piece, it's no different than Michelangelo chiseling David. Once you've put that energy into it, the energy never leaves. And people have to bow down to it, especially those that have the capacity to understand what it is they're witnessing. And you have to forgive those that don't, because those that don't have the capacity to recognize it, and that's fine. And that's the beauty of something that powerful. You know you've done well when you've offended some, and you've brought people to, you know, to adulation that revere it. Should be hated, and it should be loved. And when you achieve that, then you've achieved greatness. The beauty of the World's Greatest Sinner is that it exists. Sinner I've held on to, and you might wonder, for someone like you out in Detroit, just wondering what a guy like me does with a film like that, and why is it that I hold on to it just and deny the public its due? Why isn't it on DVD and mass produced and, you know, why can't I pick it up anywhere? It has to do with the fact that the World's Greatest Sinner never got its due. It never got the type of release that you do, and then it follows with a DVD. My ambition was to hold on to it and create the type of a revival of something that never, an art house type of tour or some type of, you know, some type of global release where you got recognized as an art house film that finally made it into the theaters and into the minds of the hungry public. And then you follow it with your standard DVD, because we all know that the age of DVD was the final track for those types of things. So I purposely just withdrew most of that, and I didn't do a commercial release because I was waiting for that. Now that time has passed. I do have coming up, though, within the next, I'd say the next 60 days will be a full web assault of The World's Greatest Sinner. I got to keep up with the torrents. Torrents are doing quite well, and I might as well get part. I would have held out even longer, but it doesn't behoove me to hold it any longer because the...
Is the one they show because it was on Turner?
It was on Turner Classics, yeah. And yeah. I Turner Classics paid more for The World's Greatest Sinner than anything in its history.
And they only showed it one time?
We had a two screening release deal.
So is there going to be finally a DVD release, or is it just going to be streaming? Or?
There'll be a DVD. It'll show up first when you see it on Amazon and iTunes. Then it'll be followed by everything else. It's in its full web assault mode. So you'll see it everywhere. You'll be able to get it on Netflix. You'll be able to see it on all the things that you want to see it on.
When they release things now on the web, on iTunes and stuff, do they still have commentaries and stuff like that?
You'll just get the movie. But if you had a movie with commentary, you'd get that too. It depends on what was packaged into it.
Uh-huh.
To me, I think Criterion should release this.
Absolutely. Yeah. The problem with most entities is they don't want to step up. Everybody wants something for free. You can't buy how old is the world's greatest sinner? 1961. You don't buy vintage wine with beer money. Doesn't happen. I was trained by my dad to handle things in a fashion that is fair and equitable. I don't need to do anything that isn't befitting to the cause.
60 days. Can folks pick this up for Christmas, or are we going to miss that window?
Yeah, I think it'll be up against that. I might be able to speed it up. I think we're on the cusp of it. We're on the cusp of it. The nice thing is, in doing this, it'll help out in getting to work on all the unfinished work that's in the archive here. One of the things you don't do as a farmer is you don't farm and toil and sweat, blood, and tears, and then take your goods and just give them all away because you got nothing to grow for the next year. My dad's energy and his sacrifice goes back into the farm so that I can produce other fruits of his labor. And they exist because it's all right here. I got them all in vaults, still waiting to see the light of day. And so once this happens, maybe I'll get some help. I haven't worked on my website since 2005 or something. So I got lots of work I got to do. I'm coming back big. I've got a book in the works. I've got some spoken word and some musical creations here with John Easdale. Yeah, I've got the book that just came out from Dead Flowers, which is available now on Amazon. I've got all the makings and trappings of a big release, even though it was created, 50 years ago. Not bad to have a conversation like that in 2011, right?
What were some of the most surprising things that you found out about Sinner while you were either growing up or while you're doing your research?
Probably, interviewing all the people that were alive, from the editors to guys like Ray Dennis Steckler, Gil Barreto. I found it interesting dealing with Carl Mahakian, who edited it, that he was a sound editor working on Sound of Music. My father spoke with him because he was doing a job at the studio, and they got to talking, and they were both in the Marines. He said, looking for an editor to edit my film. I'm shooting something. I'm going to be finished with it pretty soon. And he said, you're a sound editor, but I'd give you a shot to edit this if you're interested. Carl Mahakian left his job doing the sound for West Side Story, and he quit to work on The World's Greatest Sinner. He wanted to be a picture editor, which they wouldn't give him an opportunity when he was working. I think he was at Warner Brothers. I'm not sure which studio he was at. But anyway, so he worked on Sinner. And what he learned on Sinner, I said, how was the editing? He says, your father was over my shoulder. He says, your father edited most of it. I didn't have a lot to do with it. He said, but having worked on Sinner allowed him to work on his second piece, which was the Manchurian Candidate. The most telling scenes in the Manchurian Candidate were edited by the same guy who edited The World's Greatest Sinner. And guys like Ray Dennis Steckler would have never, ever done the work that he did had he not been inspired by my father.
Now, I read once that Edgar Ulmer had something to do with the film.
Yeah, he worked on it. He was a guy who worked on it early. He was one of the... My dad had several camera people, several cinematographers. He was someone who worked on it. And, the other thing is The World's Greatest Sinner wasn't his first adventure in film. His first movie was Al, which was L.A. spelled backwards. It's called Detour L.A., and I discovered it in the vault. He talked about it all the time, and I always wondered if it really existed. And in fact, it does. And some of it melted down, just had a chemical reaction. But I discovered and I transferred. I got on HD some amazing footage shot early downtown LA, all on the freeway. It was like The Bicycle Thief. It all happened in one day. And you've got one scene at the end of it. You see my dad actually directing, crossing the frame. It's just this amazing, amazing film. I'm working on putting the sound to it and putting all the elements together and creating the, at least the existing version of that film. You saw Tweets, his third film. What did you make of Tweets, Mike?
Tweets was like a trip without having to take drugs.
I go back to, you know, revering somebody for their abilities in the artistic world of film, and the antithesis of Sinner, you know, going from Satan to Santa Claus, riding his own vehicle and just creating something out of nothing. It's quite remarkable. How could Tweetwig possibly be Clarence Hilliard? That character and the style of editing that he created was, I think, groundbreaking.
Yeah, I was curious how much of that, I mean, because the version that I saw was what, like 70 minutes or something?
Right.
And you said that there were, like, it was almost like a whole season worth of television shows.
In the vault, full living Technicolor are something like, you know, I think it was 12 episodes, half-hour episodes. And that was the one-hour feature film version of it. He shot for years. Cassavetes loved the idea. And so Cassavetes actually financed part of it. He raised money using a lot of his friends. And my dad shot for years. He thought he had an in at NBC because he had a programmer there that said, absolutely, keep stockpiling him. We'll put him out. We'll put him out the air. Just finish him and we'll get him. Kept saying next season, next season. And my dad kept stockpiling. When they saw the pilot, they didn't know what to do. You just saw that 1 hour feature version of it. Yeah, no, the episodes go on. It's one of those things that guys just keeps getting sacked, right? He's a tweet twig. What do you call a canary that gets run over by a lawnmower? Shredded tweet. And so tweet twig, the basic storyline is tweet twig, you know, he's just a born loser. He can't put things together, you know what I mean? But he's happy. He's like, life is good. He's got a wife. He's got little old ladies that befriend him, and he's got his animals that he rescues. He's got a mission in life, and so he just can't hold a job. And his mission was every week, you know, the old ladies found him a new job. He got fired from everything he ever attempted. And the beauty of that was just humility. Have you ever heard Salvador Dali, which my father is and has been long coined? And, you know, The Insect Trainer was a collaboration with Timothy Carey and Salvador Dali. And it was Salvador Dali. There's a not so popular story where Salvador Dali in New York is sitting at a crowded intersection on a stoop. A blind man walks by. And as the blind man walks by, Salvador Dali gets up from his stoop and trips him. And everybody sees it. They just can't believe it. Just changed the whole tenor of what was happening in that on that little corner. And they said, why did you do that? And he said, because I wanted it to be surreal. And in order to be surreal, which was the same mission of my father was a thespian equivalent to Salvador Dali. To be surreal, you have to have the courage to trip the blind man. And my father had no problem tripping the blind man.
All right, so that was Romeo Carey with special surprise guest John Easdale. Good news coming out of the Carey compound with a legit DVD release coming our way. It sounds like there are a lot of great things still hanging out in the archives. One of those is a short that Romeo calls Cinema Justice, which is an outtake from the film Tarzana. I had the good fortune of speaking to Michael C. Gwynn about his role in Tarzana and his friendship with Timothy Carey. We're doing an episode on World's Greatest Sinner, and I wanted to talk to you since you had experience with, and I use experience very broadly, experience with Tim Carey.
Yeah, several times. We became friends for many years. I met Tim, well, first of all, I saw Tim when I was 14 or 15 years old in the movie Paths of Glory and was struck by the originality of his performance even before I knew I wanted to be an actor. He was just an extraordinary character. And I realized I'd seen him also when I was much younger in the James Dean movie, East of Eden. playing a bartender. Years went by. I was in radio for many years, and then I got into acting in Hollywood and began working on some shows, the different TV shows. And I got a call from a young man who wanted me to read a script. He was doing a student film, and he wanted me to read a script that was going to be 30 minutes, a short black and white homage to the noir films of the 40s. He needed a hard-boiled detective type, and I said I would be, interested in reading the script. And he came by my house on the Hollywood Hills, and he dropped off. We talked and chatted outside of my patio, and then he left the script behind. And I took a read, and it was interesting. It had a couple of jokes in it. It was sort of amateurish in another couple of ways. It was funny. It had a few moments, and it was very broadly drawn. And there was no money involved, and I didn't have any idea where he was going to get the equipment. He just was going to rent it on the weekends when it was cheap, and it had all the earmarks of a bad idea. And I was getting ready to turn him down the next time he came for a visit, and he came, and we sat outside again, had some tea, and I said, Steve, I don't know really what I can do here. This is going to keep me busy for my weekends for, looks to me like, a long time, and my weekends are pretty special to me when I've been working all week, and I don't know. And he said, well, that's too bad. I think you should know that I've got Eddie Constantine to play a part, and I didn't know who Eddie was at the time. Turns out to be he was a great European actor. And I said, well, that's very good. Then you've got some people, and you've got some good cinematography. That's great. And he said, yes, and I have Tim Curry playing Benny. What? I said, Timothy Curry, the actor. Good God, I said, how did you do that? That's the guy, the main guy I play with. He said, yes, that's why I thought you two would be a fabulous pair. Oh, boy, that was it. I couldn't turn it down now. I said, okay, when do we start? And the whole thing was pretty much of a nightmare. But the first night, I don't know, Steve, he must have had some incredible connections. Not only did he get a number of very good actors, well-known actors, but he got a very series of very good cinematographers. He had some good equipment on the set. He knew what he was doing, except part of being a director, it was new to him. And he had Timothy Carey. And so I really thought, all right, something's going on. First night of shooting, the jail down in Long Beach, getting there about 11 o'clock at night. I know this is going to be an all-nighter, but Tim Curry's going to be there, and I was looking forward to that. I get to the jail, get my wardrobe on, and Steve says, come on, I want to introduce you to Tim. Tim seems to know who you are. We get to the room, which was basically the jailer's office, using as a dressing room now, and there he was sitting on his chair, and I walked into the room, and I said, hi, my name is Michael Gwynn. And he said, Michael, I know who you are. Wonderful to see you. This is Charlie. And he had some guy, Charles, standing beside him. Charles, go get Michael some water. I said, no, I don't need any water, Tim. I just want to say that it's very nice meeting you. I've seen your work over the years, and we're going to have some fun on this show. We're going to have a lot of fun. Don't worry about it. So, Tim, what do you think we should do? Do you want to run the lines? I don't want to run any lines. And he began to quote, word for word, Salvador Dali's essay on the origin of farting, which I had coincidentally read in my Salvador Dali book. It was a sort of an intellectual treatise going back to the Romans on how farts began to evolve. And it was a complete nonsense. But Tim had it down word for word. I was very impressed because I had just read it a few months previously. And Charles was sent to get me water. And water he brought back, and we began to talk. And the first thing I noticed about Tim was that he was not a very good listener, which is to say, it could be a problem as an actor. You don't really have yourself open for the input of another person, which I find personally sometimes very refreshing and even exciting if somebody's putting something out. Tim was not what I would call a generous actor. He put something out there, and if you didn't respond to it, he was going to steamroll it right over you. But we knew a lot of the same people. He'd worked with Marlon Brando, and he had a lot of great classic films under his belt. And, he told wonderful stories about his days with Kubrick in Germany, getting himself kidnapped on purpose so he could get married. I mean, there's a million great stories out there. And the one running theme you'll get from any actor who's ever worked with Tim is pretty much the same theme, which is, look out. You're going to see something that is beyond anything you've ever seen, and you best be ready for it. The short was called called Tarzano, based on something the director knew, who didn't really reveal it to us. It was an homage to the 40s of black and white. It's out there somewhere. It plays at film festivals around town. I guess it was made in 1974, 73, around there. And I got to tell you, it was an excoriating experience working with him. The short itself is only about 30 minutes long, but there's a famous outtake which has to be seen to be believed. I don't even think I can describe it, but I was there and witnessed it. It really has to be seen. If you can find this short, you'll be really exposed to Timothy Carey at his best. Well, it's, you know, it was one little snippet, but I'll tell you something. Psychologically, it was important, because when you see the picture, and when any of your listeners or viewers actually get to see the picture and the outtake, this psychological observation of mine will make sense. And it goes like this. Tim and I were standing outside waiting for the scene, a very simple scene. I go into his office and tell him I'm willing to take this case that he's handed me of a stowaway young woman who he has captured, he being a customs agent at a port in Long Beach, and he's found this woman. He wants me to take the case, find out who her parents are, who she's connected to. The scene is, I go into the office, I say, okay, Benny, I guess I'll take this on. What have you got? You got some contraband bribes for me, pal? Which is my cue, and he passes me two or three bottles of scotch that he has, you know, taken from other people, and that's the end of the scene. I think I have one or two more lines, and then it's so long, Benny, and I'm out the door. The whole scene, probably 45 seconds. A minute at the most. So we block the scene. We go in, the cameras are ready, I open the door, Tim's standing behind his desk. We basically block this. It's not much action here. Tim's sitting at his desk and I'm standing beside it, blah, blah, blah. And he hands me the bottles, I'm out the door. Okay, action. So we do a rehearsal. And the rehearsal, you know, like most rehearsals, kind of bland, nothing really happening yet. So, well, all right, we walk through, the blocking is good, the cameras are happy, sound is happy. Okay, go back out in the hall, waiting for some lighting adjustments, standing out in the hall with Tim, Steve, the director, who has never directed actors before, let alone a powerful force of nature that is Timothy Carey, came out into the hallway and said, okay, this is going to be a great scene. Now, listen, Tim, I want you to know that you can do anything here. You know, feel free to improvise, feel free to, you know, have some fun with this scene. And then he left. And I thought to myself, oh, that's not going to be good. So I looked up at Tim's face and he had a pained look. And I said, what's up? And he said, he doesn't like me. I said, what do you mean? I don't know. You know, he doesn't like what I did. I don't know what to do now. I mean, I don't know what to do. I said, Tim, look, the guy's never directed actors before. And let's just go in and do the scene, have some fun. You know, that's all he wants. I don't think he meant to hurt your feelings. He doesn't like me. Help me. Help me do the scene. Michael, tell me what the scene is going to be okay. He was like in hell. He made me take him by the shoulders and shake him and say over and over again, it's going to be okay, it's going to be okay. That's how upset he was, because it occurred to me right then and there that Timothy Carey is an actor who you don't say you can do anything to. You hold him on a tight leash. You keep him focused. You keep him tight, and then you'll get an extraordinary performance. So when this guy unwittingly said, you know, do anything, Tim took it the completely opposite way. So now with that in mind and feeling extraordinarily put upon and vulnerable to failure, action was called, and I walked in the room and I looked at him sitting on the desk, and he was in another world. He began improvising. He began singing. When I asked him a line, I waited for my cue. It never came. The outtake is 18 minutes, scene that should have been one. 18 minutes of extraordinary crazy, which, as you've seen it, you know. Left standing there waiting for my cue. Any other actor in the business, and there have been many, would have, you know, threatened violence and walked off the set, or the scene, certainly, and that has happened in the past, but I thought any minute he's going to come out of this, and of course then I became a witness. At one point, knowing it was a master shot, I caught a quick look back to the director, and he was standing there with his mouth open, and the whole crew was like aghast, and then he found that shopping cart full of empty liquor bottles, and he began clanging it and crashing it, and I saw the sound guy rip his earphones off in agony, and everybody was so hypnotized by this non-stop performance, including myself, that finally I heard the camera guy say, we're out of film. That's it. And, you know, and then all of a sudden everybody woke up from this trance and Tim left the room and it was 4 o'clock in the morning. And I said, I'm going home. And I don't know whether this scene is ever going to work at all. So that's the story of Tim and this extraordinary outtake, which you and your viewers will undoubtedly take a look at when it comes up again. Other than that, we became friends for many years. After that, I did an episode of 10 Speed and Brown Shoe with him, which was interesting. Ben Vereen, who was the star, couldn't figure Tim out. And I was playing Tokar the Magnificent, a crazy guy in a lunatic asylum who uses Tim as a weapon to break out. And he scared everybody to death on that set. And that's pretty much what he did. He used to come visit me. I loved him dearly. He was a dear heart and an extraordinary personality. In the early days of answering machines in the 70s and early 80s, I would come home and the entire cassette would have been used up, like one call, and it was him. And he would just do, he would read, he would talk, he would rhapsodize. This was Tim's nature. He came to my door once, 10:30 at night, and had an award for me that he found somewhere with Charles at his side, and made a presentation speech as one of the great actors of the world. I go, Tim, this is for you. And I'm standing there, Tim, come on in. No, I can't come in. I got to give the award. And we lost track of each other for a couple of years. And then I heard that he had passed, 1995. And I got a call from Romeo, his son. And I said, you know, I would like to be a pallbearer. And he said, absolutely. So I got to bury my friend on the side of the hill in Forest Lawn Cemetery, where he resides to this day, no doubt entertaining the spirits below.
I'm sure.
There's never been a force like him. Not a lot of people like this man. And he would steal a scene from you when you were standing there. This is the ultimate scene stealer. When they fired him from Paths of Glory, James Harris, the producer, said, you're fired, go home, you've already stolen everything. I mean, Kirk Douglas had a hell of a time with him, but Kubrick knew that there was a force here. He used him a couple of times in The Killing as Nicky, the guy with the rifle who shoots the horse.
Yeah,
Of Glory, that scene where he and the other two guys are going to be executed, there's no sound, just the music playing, and they were to be taken up there and shot. That was the scene. But on the walkthrough, Tim began lamenting, I don't want to die, I don't want to die, and he began doing it, and Kubrick saw something happening, and he went over and told the sound guy to follow him with the boom, and he came up to Tim. Tim told me this. He came up to Tim and he said, okay, you got one shot, Kirk does not like it. And, of course, it was so underlined the meaning of the film, the senseless and uselessness of this kind of sacrifice of soldiers because they were perceived cowardice. It's the essence of that wonderful story written by Humphrey Cobb many years ago and made into a great movie by Kubrick. So Kubrick used him because he knew he was already something. Directors don't, especially technical directors, they don't want to spend much time with actors. They want to film things. They want to shoot phenomena, architecture, sunsets, human behavior. And a lot of actors, they want to ask a lot of questions. You know, what'll I do here? Then no. So hiring Tim was, you already got somebody. And believe me, that's quite a somebody to work with.
I think I've watched Cinema Justice a few times now, and I just always feel so bad for you.
I was transfixed myself. And I don't know how it got the title Cinema Justice. I don't know what that was. I don't know who gave it that title. It was thrown out. Somebody found it on the back lot at MGM being tossed out. Romeo tells the story, his son, of how somebody, when he was doing some work at MGM, somebody came to him and said, isn't your father Timothy Carey? He said, yeah. He said, we've got some footage worth tossing out here. Maybe you'd like to have it. He said, absolutely. Well, somehow Tim ended up with the footage because he called me one day to come out to his house in the Inland Empire of Los Angeles. What the hell was the name of that town? I can't remember. A goodly drive from Hollywood. Michael, please come over. I got something to show you. Oh, Tim, it's Saturday afternoon. It's a long drive. Please come over. Oh, so I drove all the way there and went to the studio in the back of his house on Weaver Street. And he had all this footage he wanted to show me. Then the reason I called you, he wanted to show me his latest walk, which consisted of moving rather cartoonishly with one arm that moved and the other arm that didn't. I said, that's really good, Tim. Where do you plan to use that? You can see some of it in the outtake in what's called Cinema Justice now. He takes it upon himself to physically become a cartoon, which you're sort of left with, like, what cartoon is this and who the hell am I now? And so, you know, don't feel sorry for me. I was really, really feeling sorry for him. He was in a great deal of psychic pain thanks to the unwitting, you know, lack of, lack of trust from the director. you know. So, I mean, I miss him daily, and of course I always love to see him make appearances on screens.
Well, I thought the Allosaur was extinct, Benny.
Wahoo!
Talking about Mount Mona, you didn't tell me.
Oh, yeah. Got a couple of Big Brother attitude towards her, you know, and got a couple of sailors on the way over here. Got a little problem here. Got to work out a joint that's giving me trouble. Anyway, I want to just say this much to you. I got a little of my trouble with my gas knock beam here. That'll work out right, you know. When I see you, I go right back to that training. Here, four, two, three, four, three.
Well, you got a great office, Benny. Looks terrific. You've done well for yourself. You love to be ready. I can understand.
That old gas knock.
Well, look, why don't you give me a tour of this office? Now, look, Benny, do me a favor.
I had that grenade launcher, and I looked at him right over there. That goop was right over the rear end of that left truck. I knew you were watching him, and I was watching him, too. I looked down, and I hugged you. I said, Sarge, say a prayer for me. You said a prayer. How about that? I held my breath. I looked up. I looked at the stars. There were stars around. There was a four-quarter half moon with an eclipse on the side joint. And I knew then that we were going to stay forever. I knew you would come back into my life. Oh, gee, what a tear. What a tear I got. I have a tear, the biggest tear in the world could drop. It could drown both of us. But I won't do it. And they came over. And I turned to him. I said, get the wonton subs. He said, Tim, get the bullets. Put them in the gun. I shot them out like that. And there we were, all alone. Just you and I. Everybody was dead. Even that lieutenant, that second lieutenant, that snotty guy from West Point, Steve DeJarnette, he got in front of our muzzle because he looked like a half gook. I couldn't help it. I didn't mean to pull the trigger. You put him right there. We buried him right under the wonton tang soup. There's probably flowers growing there today. I don't like to admit that. It was a war. Everybody dies in a war, right?
It's long past.
I didn't die in a war. Let me go back to my chair.
Long past.
I got my medals in there. My medals will console me. What do I care? Listen to them rattle. Skeletons of them. Hundreds of them. Yeah, what's the sense? You're a hero, aren't you? You'll stay a hero all your life.
All right, Marisa, what kind of time frame are we talking about with Tarzana?
I believe it was 1975, sometime in the fall. I think it took a year to make this movie because Steve DeJarnette was only able to rent the equipment that he needed on the weekends because it was cheaper. Pretty much a year of weekends. Yeah, and at the time, Tim was mostly doing his TV work. He was in Beretta and Starsky and Hutch.
Supertrain.
Yeah, that was a little bit later. But yeah, his career was starting to edge out a little bit.
Hillary Queen,
yes. Airwolf, which was his last.
As the Catman.
The Catman,
he was so good.
He was so great in that. Wasn't he great?
It was nice to see him show up in The Greatest American Hero a couple times, too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm a big fan of that. Though I think my favorite role of Tim Curry's ever was in DC Cab. And then he was doing a lot of stuff on his own, too. I mean, can you tell folks at home what was going on with The Devil's Gas and the whole Godfather thing? And but mostly Tweets Ladies of Pasadena. I don't know if I ever told you this story, but I actually drove from Detroit all the way to Philadelphia just to see Tweets Ladies of Pasadena because they were showing it. It was worth the trip.
Oh, man. I'll tell you. I bet it was. All of it?
It seemed to have kind of a beginning and kind of an end, and then just a lot of stuff happening in between it. Like, at one point, I leaned over to my friend, Mike Falloon, who was sitting next to me, and I was just like, did you put something in my water? Because feels like I'm on a trip right now. We were just completely flabbergasted.
Oh, my Lord. Oh, that's awesome.
With all those weird, like, audio overlaps and stuff. Talk about, like, strange technical stuff. There were times where certain inanimate objects or animals or things would be talking, and you wouldn't realize where the voices were coming from because they would just kind of, like, come anywhere, you know, and...
Oh, my goodness.
No shot of the actual object that was supposed to be talking or something. Oh. And the whole thing, how the woman who was playing his wife had passed away. So, like, you didn't see her the whole time. You know, and they would use that body double and stuff.
Oh, no.
Oh, man. Yeah. You know, and there are very few films where I just leave the theater completely in shock. Antichrist, Human Centipede, whatever, you know. Serbian film, you got nothing compared to Tweets Ladies of Pasadena.
No.
You leave the theater feeling like the little kid from Serbian film. So. Yeah. So, yeah, what was going on? I've seen little clips of him doing, like, wasn't he supposed to be in The Godfather 3, or was it supposed to be in the earlier Godfather films? What's the whole story with that? Do you know?
He was supposed to be in the first Godfather film. He was actually supposed to play Luca Brasi. Coppola wanted him really bad for that part, but he was filming Tweets. And he wanted to stick with doing that. Also, he felt that once he got into a, you know, big budget production like that, that it would be all about the money. And he was afraid of getting co-opted by the system. But he would have been, his younger brother, George, said that that was the biggest mistake he ever made, was not playing Luca Brasi. And in the second one, he was supposed to be the mafioso who gets killed on the stairs towards the beginning of the film. He was apparently ready to do that, but he did his firing blanks at people trick. He went into the office of Coppola and Fred Roos, the producer, and said, I've brought you these cannolis as a sign of respect. And he reaches into the box and pulls out his .38 pistol and fires blanks at Coppola, and then fires him at himself. And he fell on the desk and all the papers went flying, and Coppola thought it was great. He grabbed the gun and fired back at him, you know, bang, bang. And Roos was like horrified. It cost him the part. This is a trick that he did several times. Yeah. And then the third one, he did this little sort of like a demo reel audition type of thing to play Don Altobello in Godfather 3. And apparently Coppola was sold on it. He said, yeah, let's do it. And then Tim had a stroke.
Oh, no.
Yeah. One of his, the first of several strokes that he had. So that never happened either. But you can see The Godfarter 3, as it's called, on the DVD that you can get at Absolute Films.
You're my Timothy Carey expert. There was a rumor for a long time that he was in the conversation. Was he ever in there? Because I've looked high and low in that film. I've never seen it.
I've never seen it. And from what I understand, that he was supposed to be in it. What he said was that Fred Roos, again, said that he wouldn't get paid for the dubbing. You know how they always use, you know, redubbing of dialogue after in post-production, you know, to catch what they missed. And he said Tim wouldn't get paid for that. And Tim said, oh, yeah? Well, and then in that case, you have to come over and mow my lawn. And they put a clause in the contract that said Fred Roos had to come over and mow Tim's lawn. Finally, Roos said, okay, yeah, that's not going to work. Let's get somebody else. And so Alan Garfield got the part that Tim was.
Oh, man.
But it is still appears every now and then on filmographies. It's not an IMDb page, but there's a couple of his movies that he is supposedly in, and I've watched them and I don't see him. Francis in the Navy. Mm-hmm. I don't see him in that. And I've never seen him in Get to Know Your Rabbit, supposedly listed as a policeman, but I've never seen him in it. I don't know, unless there's some missing footage somewhere.
Brian De Palma has listened to the show before, so maybe he'll listen to this one.
Really?
And give us a heads up. Yeah, you know, we listened to the Phantom episode, so maybe he's checking us out every week. So,
awesome.
Brian, if you're listening,
yeah,
let us know.
Something on this for us, would you?
And then what's the story? Was it the same dubbing thing going on with East of Eden? Because that's not his voice in there either.
No, supposedly that's Albert Dekker. What I understood was that Ilya Kazan just thought that Tim was mumbling too much or he was too hard to understand. Tim just shrugged his shoulders and said, that's the way pimps talk. It's awful. The voice and the face don't go together. And it would have been so much more effective if he'd left it and the Joe, the character, would have seen a little more strange and sinister and weird if he'd just left well enough alone.
Well, then it was interesting, too, that he came back for the miniseries version of East of Eden.
Yes, he did. Yes. He's on the total opposite side this time. He plays a preacher.
Very fiery preacher.
Yes, very fiery preacher, yeah.
So I know I'm totally putting you on the spot, but if you were to do top five Timothy Carey appearances, what would be your top five?
Well, World's Greatest Sinner, Paths of Glory, Bayou, Killing of Chinese Bookie, and The Killing.
I really love him in One-Eyed Jax. I love that film.
Yes.
I'm going to go for more the film than necessarily his performance, even though that kind of goes against what I just asked you. That one, Finger Man,
mm-hmm.
The Killing. It's a no-brainer for the last two. It's Tweets and World's Greatest Sinner.
There you go. So, awesome.
Yeah. Unfortunately, no change of habit in that.
No.
Or his role in Kung Fu, which was kind of sad. I really like Kung Fu, but just like wasn't in there enough. It should have been him and Kane having a big, you know, Kung Fu battle at the end.
Absolutely. Yeah.
In my universe, he'd be squaring off with Shatner.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Carradine and all these. Yeah, yeah. And Bert would have been on every episode of Columbo. He would have been Columbo's, like, Wilson, you know, like House goes to Wilson and yeah. Get the answer for stuff. Would have always gone to Bert, got that chili, and been like, there you go. Totally. That's it.
There you go. I just need a bowl of Bert's chili and I can solve this case. You know, I got the impression that his appearance on Mannix. Yeah, he has a small part in an episode of Mannix where he kind of plays Mannix's man on the street type of guy. Yeah, in a betting parlor. And his name is Rasmussen, but everybody calls him Moose. He's slinging the hipster lingo. You know, he calls Mannix dad. And he's wearing a medallion around his neck. And he's like, oh, I thought you were a flower child now. Well, yeah, but I have to, you know, earn bread to so I can live this way and da-da-da. So I kind of got the impression that they were almost setting him up to be a regular character, perhaps, on Mannix. But it didn't happen. Ugh.
He could have been his Huggy Bear.
Exactly.
Well, he was great, too, in the beach blanket movies and Bikini Beach.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
He was so good. I mean, every time he showed up, it was awesome. You know, and I should have included Head in that list because it is one of my favorites. But, you know, I've already talked about it, so people should have already seen it by now. But, yeah, every time he shows up in Head, it is just amazing. And then you get him and Zappa coming back together. So. Well, I heard Carrie was originally supposed to play the cow. All right. On that note, we're going to take a break and play a clip from next week's show.
Lift the phone, cool one, and call a costume company.
Any company in particular?
One that sells Santa Claus suits, complete with beards.
What sizes?
Sizes worn by Evans, Cartwell, and Jody Boy, our three-star salesman.
You shouldn't do it, Chief. It's the middle of August. Those guys will melt out there.
It's the first day of August, and they'll wear those suits every damn day until I tell them to take them off.
What's more unusual than Santa Claus selling used cars in August?
You got me for the moment.
Nothing.
All right, and we're back. That was a preview for next week's show all about Robinson DeVore's The Woman Chaser. I want to thank you again, Marisa, for coming on. Tell folks where they can go for the Timothy Carey Experience blog.
Well, that would be the Timothy Carey Experience, all one big word, .wordpress.com. Also, there's a really cool group that I moderate on Facebook that's dedicated to Tim. It's Fans of Timothy Carey. I'm not sure what the URL is, but do a search and there it will be. There's lots of really neat people there that have interesting contributions to contribute.
Yeah, and I will be posting links to that as well as to your blog. But now tell us the real exciting news, which is that you're writing a book about Carey.
I am. My husband said to me one day, you know, you should write a book about Tim. You're probably his number one fan. And then I said, well, I don't know. I've never written. I've written some articles and some movie reviews, but writing a book, I don't know. Huh. Then I heard Tim's voice in my ear saying, hey, come on, let's do this. You can do this. Come on, write a book about me. Come on. So I'm writing a book. Michael Gwynn, who you spoke to earlier, I contacted him to see if I could do an interview with him. It just snowballed from there. He's become kind of my mentor for the book. I have him read everything. He has suggestions and he's getting me interviews with people. I already did one with Don Calfa, who co-starred with Tim in Peeper. I've been just writing to people right and left and gathering info and going to New York and California and slowly but surely coming together. When will it come out? Good question.
Pick that right out of my head. I was going to ask you what kind of internal deadline you have.
I don't know. Hopefully in maybe the next year or so. Fingers and toes crossed, knock on wood. Stay tuned. Watch this space. Check the blog and all will be revealed.
Well, you know, when that comes out, we'll have you back on the show and talk about the books more and talk more about Carey, because we can never talk too much about Tim Carey. And hopefully by then, more people will have been able to see The World's Greatest Sinner. Hopefully more people will be able to see that on Netflix or however it comes out. I'm still waiting for a Criterion release of it, personally.
Absolutely. Yeah, if they can do Godzilla, they can do The World's Greatest Sinner. I'm sorry.
If they can do Armageddon, they can do The World's Greatest Sinner.
That's exactly. Come on.
Yeah. The bar was lowered so much by Armageddon. And World's Greatest Sinner it's right up there with the classics for me. And I'm being 100% serious because this was such a true American vision of a film.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you don't get a guy squaring off against God very often.
You don't.
He does it.
He does it.
He does it. Yeah. Man. Yeah. That last bit is just it works perfectly. I don't want to give away anything for folks listening at home, but oh my goodness.
I know.
Doesn't get any better.
It doesn't. No. Independent filmmaking at its finest.
All right, Maurice, I want to thank you again so much for coming on, and I hope that folks will go over to your blog, check out everything, and just, like I said, subscribe to the Facebook groups, subscribe to the blog, either way that you want to do it, because every day, I mean, talk about dedicated, every day you've got something new up there, and it's just always incredible.
Well, thank you, Mike. It's been a pleasure, and I do hope to come back. It's great. Oh. This is the best podcast ever.
Just because you're on it, right?
Right.
Thanks for listening, folks. Be sure to check out more episodes of The Projection Booth over on iTunes via Stitcher or on Jackalope Radio or right at our website at projection-booth.com.
It's fantastic. The best seat in my household is reserved for you, but you must keep up this high score. The representative will call on you to ensure your greatest hour yet to come. In other words, Clarence, go to hell!
The core, baby, you can't say no more, cause he's the world's greatest sinner. Well, if you've ever sinned before, then you know what I mean. Well, if you see him walking around the floor, he's the meanest creature that you've ever seen. He's the world's greatest sinner. I said the world's greatest sinner. Well, he could rock Cindy Linder. Yeah, he's little girls for dinner. He's badass, you bet. And he ain't started yet, cause he's the world's greatest sinner. The cold, baby, you can't say no more. He's the world's greatest sinner. Yeah, he's the world's greatest sinner, baby. You better watch out for him. Oh yeah, world's greatest sinner. Yeah.
Hey, give your bowl of chili free.